I'm Lester Holt. Tonight on Dateline, she vanished one holiday weekend. Now, the latest in the headline-making mystery of college student Kristen Smart.
This picture of my friend is on the TV. It was that she's missing. And that's all we knew about anything for years.
My parents were unrelenting. Every last waking minute was dedicated to finding my sister.
The police are kind of like, well, maybe she's camping. Maybe she's out with friends.
There was certainly a perception that law enforcement had kind of fallen short.
Yeah, there were some mistakes made early on.
I'm retracing Kristen Smart's last known steps.
This podcast sort of raised this case to a national level again.
How many people contacted you?
I think hundreds, if not thousands.
Something's got to break. Something's got to give.
I was like, holy smokes, this is the guy.
Here's Josh Mankiewicz with The Vanishing of Kristen Smart.
She loved it here. The Pacific. Open. Free. Full of possibility and adventure. Back then, those words also described Kristen Smart.
It was really just that boundless energy and that boundless determination to live life to the fullest.
Kristen, just 19 years old.
Everybody knew Kristen was there when she walked into a room because she was just tall and gorgeous and legs for days.
A college freshman when she vanished. Now a quarter century has passed.
Kristen Smart.
Kristen Smart.
Kristen Smart.
It's a story that grew to more than the sum of its parts.
It's a mystery that leaves the Smart family haunted.
Through the years, through the graduations, Kristen's presence lingered, quiet, but constant, in the poster on the highway and on the pathways through the red brick dorms where she was last seen. It's a kind of ripple effect that started long ago and now has resurfaced. Will justice finally be served? And if so, will it arrive too late?
To think that he's been out there doing this allegedly for 25 plus years, it makes my stomach turn.
Matt Smart was a sophomore in high school in 1996. That's when his world collapsed.
So I was just a young guy, 14, 15 years old.
What's that like?
I mean, there's no words to really elegantly describe it, nor do I think there'll ever be.
The unthinkable came in the form of a phone call. Matt's big sister, Kristen, was missing. There'd been no sign of her for 2 days. And just as concerning was this. Anyone who knew Kristen also knew she would never disappear without a word.
She wasn't someone who wanted to take risks.
Carla Hoffman is a longtime friend of the Smart family.
Though she loved seeing the world, and she had been to South America, and she'd been to England, and she'd been to Hawaii, but she had been with people she knew and trusted.
She wasn't going alone.
No. No.
The firstborn of Stan and Denise Smart's 3 children, Kristen grew up in Stockton, California, in the state's Central Valley. After graduating high school, she spent the summer working as a camp counselor in Hawaii.
She was a lifeguard. She was always there watching everybody.
Fellow counselors Rachel and Kristen lived in a cabin together alongside their young campers.
We had the youngest kids. Some of them were 6 and 7 years old who had never been away from their family before for even a night. So we got to deal with the homesick campers and we had a dance every weekend. The kids all wanted to dance with Kristen because she was always kind of dancing and having fun.
When summer ended, Kristen headed to college at Cal Poly, California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo, California.
But I remember the joy that she had when we dropped her off at school, how excited she was to have a roommate, how excited she was for college life.
It was still hard for her little brother to say goodbye.
And it's like, so we just leave her here? It's a lot of trust that you're putting in that.
trust that she'll make the right choices and that those around her will. Particularly because at 18 or 19, college freshmen are just on the cusp of adulthood. For Kristen, that brought a time of reinvention. She started going by other names like Roxy or Kiana. And amid the uniform blondness of Cal Poly, she dyed her hair brown.
That makes sense to you that she'd be sort of like trying on this new persona?
I mean, at 19, you have this freedom. Your parents aren't there all the time. You're starting to live your life. You're alone at a school.
Well, you're this semi-adult for the first time.
With, like, this freedom that you've never had, right? You're finding out who you are.
And as Kristen was finding herself, she wondered if Cal Poly was truly where she belonged. This confident world traveler unexpectedly missed the comforts of familiar surroundings.
This was a girl who was homesick, who was not really happy there, who at one point asked her parents if she could return home and go to school locally. And her parents said, finish the year, and then if you want to change and come home, you can.
And so she stuck it out. And when Memorial Day weekend 1996 arrived near the end of that freshman year, it was time to celebrate. Kristen headed to an off-campus party. It was the last evening she'd be seen alive.
What happened to Kristen that night? When we come back...
I never saw her actually drinking, but she was definitely under the influence of something.
Several people had offered to walk her home or take her home.
The disappearance that launched a 25-year-old mystery.
What do you mean Kristen's missing? She's missing. What are you talking about?
The young women who lived in Kristen Smart's college dorm were the first to realize something is wrong here. Kristen had gone to a party the Friday evening of Memorial Day weekend and never returned. Her dorm mates called campus police. Word spread to family and friends.
It's like surreal, I think. It was a weird, what do you mean Kristen's missing? She's missing. What are you talking about? I did ask, did she have her credit cards and her makeup? Because Kristen always had that stuff with her no matter where she was.
And on the bed in her dorm room, Kristen's roommate found her purse, makeup, and keys.
When I found that out, I was like, okay, something happened to her because she wouldn't be anywhere without that.
When he heard Kristen was missing, her father Stan didn't wait. He got in his car and drove more than 250 miles to San Luis Obispo.
He said he was going into dumpsters.
Reporter Megan Healy has covered the case for NBC affiliate KSBY in San Luis Obispo.
He looked in every nook and cranny for her, just desperate to try and find her.
The Cal Poly campus police did not seem to share that sense of urgency.
The police are kind of like, well, maybe she's camping. Maybe she's out with friends. She'll be back.
And so 3 days passed before campus police began investigating, talking with students who'd seen her last. They learned Kristen had gone to a party here.
The night of the party, it was a very low-key, kind of boring event.
Trevor Bolter was a sophomore at Cal Poly back in 1996. He told police he was at the party.
What was going on?
Music. People were playing pool and a whole lot of nothing. I mean, really, it was not a wildly populated party.
A memorable party? No. Except for a certain young woman.
This very tall, very attractive girl wearing shorts and a t-shirt walks up to me and says, "Hi, I'm Roxy." Okay? And I go, "Hi." She leans in and she kisses me, like full-on kisses me.
He didn't know it, but that was Kristen Smart, the newly minted adult, calling herself Roxy.
You've never met her before?
Never met her before in my life, okay? She grabs my hand, and she takes me to the bathroom. Okay, so my head's spinning a little bit because, you know, I'm 20, and I'm like, okay, this beautiful girl has kissed me, and she's pulling me into the bathroom. What's going on here?
Once in the bathroom, Trevor says, her mood changed.
She's at the mirror. She's doing her makeup. She goes, "Do you think I'm ugly? Do you think I'm ugly?" And I'm like, "No, you're beautiful, right?" Because she, girl's beautiful. And she goes, "Okay, I have to use the bathroom now." So like suddenly, like as if I've invaded her space into the bathroom, I'm like, okay. So I walk out of the bathroom.
Trevor says that when he came out of the bathroom, he had another strange encounter.
This guy that I've never seen before, like, is right in my face. And he's like, what I'd like to know is what you did with her in the bathroom. And I was like, oh, God, is that her boyfriend? I'm like, what have I gotten myself into? You know, I'm like, my head's spinning. And I go, nothing, man, absolutely nothing. And then he goes, oh, laughs. He goes, oh, cool. And I was like, oh, you're some dorky kid.
It was kind of weird, Trevor said. He went back to his friends, his beer, and he kept an eye on Roxy.
I never saw her actually drinking, but she was definitely under the influence of something. Okay, so she was just acting inebriated. So I felt a concern. I just want to make sure she's okay, right? You know?
Other partygoers told police that by the early morning hours, Kristen was in bad shape. Students found her lying in the front yard of the party house, apparently unable to stand up.
So several people had offered to walk her home or take her home because it's kind of a sloping hill back up to campus.
A female student and a male freshman escorted Kristen on the final leg back to her dorm. The freshman happened to live in the dorm right across this path from Kristen. He assured the other young woman he could get Kristen the rest of the way home.
And in her mind, she said, you know, to herself that she didn't think anything bad was going to happen.
They split off here, just a few steps to Kristen's dorm. She apparently never arrived there. So now investigators had a whole lot of questions for that last person to see Kristen Smart alive.
Coming up, who did last see Kristen alive? And what was his story?
I walked with her to where the driveway was, and I went off to my dorm because the walkway goes that way towards my dorm, and then she started walking that way.
When Dateline continues.
Days after Kristen Smart disappeared, campus police were charting her final movements. Quickly, a name emerged. Cal Poly student Paul Flores.
He was the last one to see Kristen alive.
Ian Parkinson was an officer at a local police department when Kristen vanished. Today, 25 years later, he's sheriff of San Luis Obispo County.
It was very clear that he was the last one to walk away from her that night, and she was never seen after that. So that would immediately make him a person of interest.
Paul Flores came to Cal Poly from nearby Arroyo Grande, where his parents lived. Those who knew him described Paul as awkward, a loner. He was a freshman, majoring in food science. And he was at the party Friday night. Remember the guy Trevor had seen while exiting the bathroom? The one he assumed was Kristen's boyfriend?
And when I finally saw a picture of Paul Flores, that was the guy who came up to me outside of the bathroom with this like sense of ownership over Kristen. So I know that for a fact.
Campus police spoke with Paul 3 days after Kristen disappeared. He told them he walked back to campus with Kristen, but that he left Kristen when she got near her dorm. While talking with Paul Flores, investigators noticed something.
He has a black eye, and he's got scratches on his hands and knees.
Chris Lambert grew up near San Luis Obispo. He spent more than a year studying Kristen's case and speaking with people close to the investigation. He says Paul Flores' shiner made investigators instantly suspicious.
What is Mr. Flores' explanation for that black eye?
It depends on when you ask him. First, Paul Flores says that he got elbowed during a game of basketball that took place on that Monday. Then the police interview the people he was playing basketball with, and they say that he arrived to that game with that black eye. And he told all of them that he just woke up with it and didn't know how he got it.
There was different versions of the story.
It was enough to make campus police enlist the help of the San Luis Obispo District Attorney's Office.
I don't remember even doing anything like that.
An investigator pressed Paul about those changing stories. Paul now told them he got the black eye while working on his truck.
So maybe what you're telling us isn't really the truth. How do we know now that you lied to us?
Well, that wasn't important, though.
Sure, Dennis, that's important.
One thing that didn't change, Paul's account about walking Kristen back to the dorms.
I walked with her to where the driveway was, and I went up to my dorm because the walkway goes that way towards my dorm, and then she started walking up that way.
The investigators leaned in.
Let's suppose that something bad happened to her, and she's not alive anymore. What would be your best guess or your opinion as to what happened to her if she's not alive anymore? What do you think happened?
I would say like someone who she hitchhiked with or something abducted her or something, you know.
Investigators weren't buying that, but without any real evidence to hold him, out the door Paul went. That was the last time he sat down with investigators. About a week after that interview and a full month after Kristen Smart went missing, the case was passed to the San Luis Obispo Sheriff's Department. One of their first moves, a search of the dorms. But by then, Paul Flores and the rest of the students had gone home for the summer.
Paul Flores' room was cleaned after he left it. And whatever evidence might have been there was lost. How big a deal is that?
It's a very big deal.
Because that's potentially the scene of the crime.
Potentially, absolutely. I mean, anything Paul would have been wearing is evidence. I mean, we get trace evidence of fibers, of DNA, hairs, all the time. And if all that stuff is missing, then you're missing a big piece of the puzzle.
An empty room can still reveal secrets. Investigators brought in cadaver dogs.
Four cadaver dogs alerted to the scent of human decomposition in Paul Flores' bedroom, and only Paul Flores' bedroom out of all the dorms on campus.
Next, investigators searched the home of Ruben Flores, Paul's father.
They found newspaper clippings about this case, and they said, well, we were just saving those because it was a girl he went to school with.
Suspicious, maybe, but nothing close to tying Paul to any crime. The Smarts poured every mental and emotional reserve they had into finding their daughter.
Team number 3, behind the squad leader with his hand up, please.
And the community of San Luis Obispo joined in.
I was chatting with my dad the other day how many searches took place. I mean, I can't even put a number to it. But you always saw them on the hillside in their orange shirts. Day after day, day after day, day after day.
Hundreds of volunteers searched the campus and the surrounding hillsides, on foot and horseback. They put up billboards. All of it was inspiring. None of it worked. 8 months after their daughter disappeared, the Smarts told NBC affiliate KSBY they were coming to a terrible realization.
I always had that little bit of hope, but I don't think that little bit of hope's there any longer. And I feel real strongly that, she didn't live beyond May 25th.
And then it was Memorial Day weekend again.
So about a year into the investigation, it seems that the sheriff's office is hitting some roadblocks. And the then sheriff at the time, Ed Williams, gives a statement to the Tribune newspaper about the state of the investigation. And if Paul doesn't talk to them and doesn't give them answers from that night, then they're not going to have any luck with this case.
Back then, that sheriff made it clear Paul Flores held all the cards. And he never went back to Cal Poly. Flores moved to Southern California, where he held a series of jobs at restaurants, a Coca-Cola bottling plant, Blockbuster Video. Paul Flores seemed to be done talking, so the Smarts found a way to make him answer their questions.
Coming up.
I refuse to answer that question.
The heat is on Paul Flores and his parents.
I'm asking you, who is your attorney?
I prefer not to let you know.
Kristen Smart's parents, frantic to find their daughter and frustrated by an investigation that had moved slowly from the start, wanted someone to press Paul Flores, and hard.
The very bottom line is finding Kristen.
After Kristen disappeared, there was certainly a perception that law enforcement had kind of fallen short.
Yeah, I don't think it's a mystery. There were some missed opportunities, mistakes made early on.
So the Smarts got an attorney and sued Paul Flores for Kristen's wrongful death.
It's every father or mother's worst fear, and there it was unfolding in my law office.
In a civil case, Murphy could do what detectives could not: question Paul Flores. Not in an interrogation, but in a videotaped deposition. And so Paul Flores answered Murphy's questions.
On the advice of my attorney,
sort of.
I refuse to answer that question based on the Fifth Amendment.
That's how he answered almost every question. Maybe taking the Fifth because this civil deposition could later be used by criminal prosecutors.
A United States Constitution.
I didn't expect any answers. I want him to look into my face because I'm the guy who keeps telling everybody that you're never going to get away with it, Paul.
The deposition is being videotaped.
Murphy also deposed Paul's parents, Reuben and Susan.
Have you ever asked your son questions about whether or not he was involved in the death of Kristen Smart?
We've never discussed it as a death. Disappearance.
Paul's mother seemed less than fully cooperative.
I'm asking you, who is your attorney?
I prefer not to let you know.
For attorney Murphy, the biggest moment came on the question Reuben Flores either could or would not answer.
Has your son ever told you that he did not kill Kristen Smart?
We never asked that question.
If that were to happen in front of a jury, that pregnant pause would have been viewed as evidence of involvement.
Investigators believed from the start that if Paul killed Kristen in that dorm, he had help moving her body.
He doesn't have his own vehicle, so he needs somebody to come. The investigators who worked on this case early on, their conclusions all seemed to be that his father was the one that helped.
Do you believe Paul Flores had help in either committing this crime or covering it up?
I think there's people that know to what extent they were involved. I don't know yet. Whether they actively aided, I don't know.
The depositions provided a lot to interpret, but not hard evidence to move the case forward. Jim Murphy would eventually withdraw the lawsuit while his team gathered more evidence. The answers the family sought seemed to be slipping away with each year. Denise Smart told her friend it sometimes felt like a sledgehammer.
She said, because not only do I not have my daughter, but I don't have any resolution. Where is she? And why is he still free?
Amid their pain, they started a scholarship in Kristen's name.
Mom's turning point became a desire to have a legacy for my sister.
Unlike the investigation, which you don't have any control over, this is something you do have some control over.
Control is important. I think we're all seeking control. It's being able to honor Kristen in a way that you're not simply putting up facts in a missing poster.
In 2002, the Smarts made a wrenching decision. They wanted to ensure Kristen's case was a murder investigation. And so they had her officially declared dead. That didn't seem to work either.
There's a point where the investigation doesn't exactly stop, but it definitely slows down. Feels like there's not a lot of progress being made.
You definitely did see that waver. You've only got so many leads to follow. When you get to that kind of dead zone, it really becomes, how do you re-energize that crowd of people? And that's something I saw my parents struggle with.
Paul Flores' parents helped him buy a house in the L.A. neighborhood of San Pedro, where he was known to frequent local bars. Over the years, Paul was convicted of driving under the influence multiple times. And we found this police report, in which a Long Beach police officer described seeing a drunk Paul Flores struggling with a woman. In that incident, he was arrested for public intoxication. Up in San Luis Obispo, Ian Parkinson was elected sheriff in 2010. During the campaign, he met with the Smarts and made a promise. If he won, he'd make Kristen's case a priority.
I hoped I'd have an answer in the first year. I truly did. You know, my first step coming in was to pull out every item of evidence and go through it. reanalyzing it with our technology.
The case was not solved that first year or the next.
The bottom line is we solve crimes through witnesses and physical evidence. And without them, you're at a distinct disadvantage.
Then someone else got involved, someone who'd been watching these events unfold since his childhood. And this investigation would take a whole new turn.
Coming up.
I'm retracing Kristen Smart's last known steps.
A new podcast breaks new ground.
How many people contacted you?
I think hundreds, if not thousands.
Frightening encounters with Paul Flores.
I thought, what in the world did you get yourself into?
When Dateline continues.
Chris Lambert was 8 years old when Kristen Smart went missing, learning about her from news reports and billboards. As Chris became an adult, and those billboards didn't come down, it jarred something in him.
I started asking friends and family members, do you remember the Kristen Smart story? And what came out was that a lot of people didn't know the details or were confused about who she was.
Chris was a recording engineer. He'd never investigated any crime, and he wasn't a friend of the Smart family. Even so, Chris felt a personal connection to the case.
It happened in my own backyard, which is why I named the podcast Your Own Backyard. I'm retracing missing Cal Poly student Kristen Smart's last known steps.
Chris launched his podcast in 2019. Through his research, hard work, and calm, unhurried voice, a lot of people around here either learned about or remembered the story of the girl on the billboard and the story of the man suspected of taking her away. What Chris did not see coming was that the podcast made people want to talk to him.
How many people contacted you and said, I have some personal knowledge of this case?
I think hundreds, if not thousands by this point.
And so Chris included stories in his podcast of people who'd crossed paths or swords with Paul Flores.
There's an incident where he's swimming in the family pool. At some point, there's a girl that he gets into a fight with, and suddenly he's holding her down under the pool so she can't breathe. Finally, an adult has to pull him off.
Chris also uncovered women from Paul's past who said they knew him by reputation.
Well, his nickname was Scary Paul.
He was, they said, a creep.
You wouldn't want to be alone in a room with him. You wouldn't let any of her friends be drunk around him.
An ex-girlfriend of Paul's told Chris about an incident that happened after Paul had been drinking.
And he had like a butter knife and he like held it to my neck and I was screaming and my roommate actually kicked down the door to make him stop.
Chris Lambert says a picture of Paul Flores started to emerge.
You're describing someone who sees women not as potential romantic or social partners, but as prey.
That's the impression that I've gotten.
He noticed you.
I guess so, yes.
This woman met Paul Flores in 2015, during the time when he frequented bars in San Pedro. We agreed to call her Sam and conceal her identity. It was late, Sam says, and she was tipsy and waiting for a ride when Flores approached her.
He asked if he could take me home. I could take you home. It's fine. And he was very persistent.
You'd never seen this guy before?
No.
Describe him.
He was awkward and he seemed meek.
Over the years, people have described Paul Flores in a number of ways, but two very common ones are that he seems scary and frightening. Mm-hmm. And other people describe him as kind of nerdy and, inoffensive, sort of a guy you almost feel bad for, sort of.
That's how I felt. Like, he's just, it's 1 a.m. and he just wants to hang out and he's being awkward about it, but let's go get something to eat.
She got into Flores's car and they drove to a restaurant.
Are you drinking?
No.
So you're not getting more drunk at this point?
No, I'm drinking water.
Afterwards, she agreed to go back to his place.
And when he opens the door, it was just a hoarding mess. It was boxes everywhere, paper, newspapers, just stacks and stacks. And I thought, What in the world did you get yourself into?
She says that on his couch, she tried to think of an exit strategy.
It's very awkward. I don't want to hurt his feelings, and I want to keep myself safe. So I don't want to upset him. He offers me water, and we still talk.
He's not doing anything other than talking.
Yeah, he's not aggressive or anything, but I know that I wanted to leave, and I don't know why I didn't muster up the energy or voice, I want to go, which...
Because you would have had no trouble saying that.
Never. I'm very, I'm feisty. If I don't like something, you'll know.
What happens next?
We go to his bedroom, and then we have relations that I'm not participating in.
Meaning he's forcing himself on you?
Not forcing. It's just, I'm just laying there. And just thinking to myself, I want this to be over. I want to go home. But I never vocally said it. And I don't know if maybe it's because I was scared that he would be aggressive or what. I don't know why I didn't just say, I'm done. I want to go.
Afterwards, Sam says she passed out, woke up a few hours later, and went home feeling groggy. She swept that whole night under a big mental rug and tried to forget it ever happened. Then, Chris Lambert's podcast blew up.
It lit a fire under the entire community, but I think law enforcement in particular were in this place where they were thinking, this is the time to move.
Coming up.
Sort of feels like you got some momentum here.
Absolutely.
A dramatic moment 25 years in the making.
I was shocked. I remember standing in the middle of the street crying.
And a stunner of a claim.
The defense multiple times have mentioned Scott Peterson.
Scott Peterson? What's that all about?
With each new episode, Chris Lambert's audience grew. Listeners fascinated by the tale of the missing girl and more than 20 years of justice denied. And if the podcast also jogged loose some old memories, Chris wanted to be sure any potential leads made their way to investigators.
You can directly contact San Luis Obispo Sheriff's Detectives.
And in 2020, search warrants were served on four of the Flores family properties. Sheriff Ian Parkinson spoke with us before a gag order was imposed in the case.
From the outside, sort of feels like you've got some momentum here.
Absolutely.
Well, it depends on how you measure that. Another year passed before deputies returned to Ruben Flores' house. A new warrant in hand. This time, they were there to dig.
We've been seeing them use cadaver dogs as well as ground-penetrating radar.
Once again, no body was found. And when that search concluded, the normally camera-shy Ruben took KSBY reporter Megan Healy on a tour.
Take a look here. Underneath the house, there are markings of rakes from investigators churning up the soil.
Then Susan Flores agreed to speak with Megan Healy on camera.
It's just nuts.
She said she has no idea what happened to Kristen Smart and that the Flores family was being unfairly targeted.
This is ridiculous what happened here today. They took his life away from him, too.
It's the story of two families on opposite sides of the same question. What would you do for your kids? The Smarts have never stopped looking for their daughter. The Floreses have done all they could to shield their son. There was no stopping what happened next. As he promised, Sheriff Parkinson's office had never stopped investigating. Quietly and deliberately, they'd worked the case, and now were ready. On April 13th, Almost 25 years to the day that Kristen Smart disappeared, Paul Flores was arrested and charged with her murder.
I was shocked. Someone said, "Did you see this happen?" I remember standing in the middle of the street crying.
There was more. Paul's father, Reuben, was charged as an accessory, accused of having helped his son dispose of Kristen's body. This summer, both sides gathered for a pretrial hearing where prosecutors laid out their case. The state revealed what that dig turned up from under the Flores deck. Staining in the dirt that tested positive for human blood.
Suggesting that a body was kept there for a while.
A body had been there, but was not there anymore.
The blood was too degraded for a DNA profile. The Flores' attorneys said the prosecution simply didn't have enough of a case. And if a murder had been committed, the defense says it could have been any number of other people, even Scott Peterson, a Cal Poly student when Kristen disappeared. He was later convicted of killing his wife, Lacey, in 2004.
The defense multiple times have mentioned Scott Peterson as a tactic to show that the sheriff's office didn't investigate anyone other than Paul, that they only honed in on Paul.
With no evidence that Scott Peterson ever met Kristen, the judge barred that as a possible defense. The defense also tried to subpoena Chris Lambert, arguing he influenced witnesses. The judge ruled against that too, citing laws that protect journalists. Trial is set for April 25th of next year.
There is a methodically slow, like molasses pace, that this has taken. But if that ultimately leads to finding a body, it'll have all been worthwhile.
You wanted to call attention to this case. You did. Now there's going to be a trial. Your mission over?
No, I think the mission all along has been, where is Kristen Smart? And there's still a question mark there.
And there are other questions about what Paul Flores knew or did. When prosecutors charged him, they added something else.
It is alleged that Mr. Flores caused the death of Kristen Smart while in the commission of or attempted rape.
They said she's not his only victim.
We do have evidence in this case that leads us to conclude that there very well may be additional victims in the Southern California area.
On Paul Flores' computers, investigators say they found videos of his sexual encounters with several women who appeared to be under the significant influence of alcohol or drugs. So far, the judge hasn't allowed prosecutors to use that as evidence in their murder case. But they believe that for two decades, drugging and then raping women he met in bars was Flores' recurring M.O.
He was known to frequent bars in the San Pedro area and in Los Angeles County.
Which brings us back to Sam's story.
Somebody posted another picture saying they were at Paul Flores' house, and that's when I was like, holy smokes, this is the guy. That creeped me out. Something just punched me in the gut.
She says that after Flores was arrested, and she heard the stories of women being drugged, something clicked.
Oh my gosh, now it all makes sense. Why everything happened the way it did.
Paul gave her water at his place.
And I don't know if anything was in there, but by 4 o'clock in the morning, after having my last drink at 1 and eating, I should have been able to say, I want to go home.
Sam is coming to terms with her feelings about an encounter she had considered weird, but consensual.
But if you were drugged, that's not consent.
No, it's not.
I mean, that's rape.
Yes. When I actually think about all the details that I remember, it hurts.
If Paul Flores is guilty of Kristen Smart's murder, then he wasn't prosecuted for it back when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he was free then.
Yes.
To assault you mm-hmm. chemically and literally, and other women too.
Yes.
All because of the inaction of law enforcement back then.
Yeah, they dropped the ball.
So go ahead and question not just the pace of justice, but whether that's even the right word for any of this. What does justice look like here? Maybe the answer is something that hasn't happened yet. That would be a family finding their daughter, and at last, laying her to rest.